facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A tremendous Tuesday to you. It is Tuesday in the octave of Easter. It's one big day that lasts 8 days celebrating the resurrection of the Lord. This is Cale Clark, and this is the number that you can call to talk to me for free. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Life Insurance. So thankful for their support of Relevant Radio. You can also email the program. The address is Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can find me on the X app as well. My handle is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Well, speaking of Clark, I'm going to go a little Clark on Clark here. I'm going to talk about, later on, Caitlin Clark. Why is she so good? And you wouldn't believe the numbers coming out of last night's game to get Iowa and Caitlin Clark into the Final Four. Wow, it really just shocked me, the Nielsen ratings on this. It's unbelievable what a big star she's becoming, taking America and the world by storm. We'll talk about her. We're also going to talk about why Americans are more unhappy than ever before, which is kind of sad in this week of Easter joy. And talk about why that is, especially younger Americans are more unhappy than ever. But first, we're going to talk about today's gospel. Why is it that the risen Jesus told Mary Magdalene not to hold on to him? Let go. Stop touching me. That's literally what it says in the Greek text of John chapter 20. And this is the gospel reading for today. Can't wait to share this with you. This is from John chapter 20, verses 11 through 18. It says, Mary Magdalene stayed outside of the tomb weeping. And as she wept, she bent over into the tomb and saw two angels in white sitting there, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had been. And they said to her, Woman, why are you weeping? She said to them, They have taken my Lord, and I don't know where they laid him. When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus there, but did not know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for? She thought it was the gardener and said to him, Sir, if you carried him away, tell me where you laid him and I will take him. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned and said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. Jesus said to her, Stop holding on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and tell them, I am going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary went and announced to the disciples, I have seen the Lord, and then reported what he had told her. It's such an incredible gospel. And Mary Magdalene, of course, the first person in the Gospel of John to encounter the risen Christ. I absolutely love this account because really Mary Magdalene is the apostle to the apostles. That's one of the great titles that she has because she goes and announces to the 12, really to the 11, of course, Judas having gone his own way. And they don't buy her story. And unfortunately, one of the reasons for that is because she is a woman. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But why does Jesus tell her not to hold on to him? It seems kind of bizarre. You'd think that he'd accept a hug from her. Oh, I'm so glad you're alive. But I think it's really intriguing that John mentions, first of all, that this takes place in a garden. And John has previously mentioned, when he talked about the burial of Jesus in his gospel, that he was buried in a garden. In a garden, there was a tomb in which no one had ever been laid. And Jesus was buried there. I think it's pretty obvious that John is referencing, once again, the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. We see this in John's prologue at the beginning, John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, that's exactly what it says in the first line of Genesis. In the beginning, John says, was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So he hearkens back to Genesis at the start of his gospel, and then there at the end, also it's back to Genesis. This time the garden, this theme of the garden and the Garden of Eden. And we have Jesus here as really the new humanity, the new man, Newman, if you will. Well, I'll get into Newman too in just a second here. Not Seinfeld related, trust me. But Jesus appears as the second Adam, and this is, of course, one of his titles in the Gospels and also in the writings of St. Paul, that Jesus is this new Adam, and he succeeds in every way that Adam failed. And really, he wants to bring us back to God's original plan for humanity. This is very much what the resurrection is all about. He's setting things right again. And again, in Genesis chapter 3, when the original sin happened, Adam and Eve fell into sin and they were kicked out of the garden. Of course, God, in kind of lecturing the serpent, the Satan, he does, of course, promise. It's called the Proto-Evangelium, the first gospel, Genesis 3:15, a promise that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. The serpent would try to strike his heel, but Jesus was going to crush his head. And that's exactly what happens with the cross and the resurrection. Now, some people have tried to say that you can't really harmonize, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later in the week, this idea that, you know, all these visitors to the tomb, who's there, which women are there, did they go at the same time? It seems like there's a bit of a conflict in the data, but that's actually not the case. If you put all four resurrection narratives together, it actually, there is a way to kind of harmonize them, but I actually think they'd be a lot more suspicious from a historical perspective if they all laid out the events in the exact same way. So I do want to focus here just on what John has to say here. And all four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all agree that a group of women set out looking for Jesus' tomb early on Sunday morning. And is it light out? Is it dark out? Is it becoming light? People argue about that. But it's early in the morning. That's all we need to know. Now, obviously, they're going as a group. They are going as a group because there's no way that a single woman is going to risk going into a graveyard late at night, early in the morning, outside of Jerusalem. So, and again, if you're making up a story here, if you think the Gospels are unhistorical, they would never invent a story about women being the first to encounter the risen Christ, specifically here, Mary Magdalene. Because don't forget, in a first century court of law, a woman's testimony was worth nothing in the Jewish world. And several of the rabbis write that a woman's testimony is on the same level as that of a robber, a murderer. I mean, essentially the implication is that they are not to be trusted. And I could read you some quotes from the rabbis, but thankfully the Catholic Church has done so much to promote the dignity and rights of women, but it wasn't really that way in the first century. So there's no way you're going to make up a story. If you're trying to convince your fellow Jews that Jesus is the Messiah risen from the dead, you're not going to invent a story where women encounter the risen Jesus. You're going to have Peter maybe do it, or John. But that's exactly what's going on here. And the light is dawning very slowly in the morning. And this is because it's really kind of a metaphor for the fact that the world still is in darkness. And even to this day, even 2,000 years after the resurrection, it is still very much in a lot of spiritual darkness, but the light is spreading. The light is spreading. The night is far gone, and the day of the Lord is almost here. And of course, Mary Magdalene shows up at the tomb, and she's like, you know, how am I going to anoint the body? She probably isn't aware that John has already said that Nicodemus has brought a tremendous amount of aloe spices to anoint the body. She's got her own stuff with her. She's probably not aware of this. But it's just amazing to see this account of Jesus, who's still kind of incognito. Now, she sees the two angels in the tomb, Mary Magdalene, and okay, but why is it that she mistakes Jesus, gloriously resurrected from the dead, as a gardener? I think this is part of the mystery of Jesus in his resurrected state. He hasn't yet ascended to the Father. It's very much like the road to Emmaus story in Luke 24, how they're kept from recognizing Jesus somehow. They just think it's some guy they met on the road walking, and they tell him about all their woes. They thought Jesus was the Messiah. Then things went bad. He got killed, and they're down and depressed. But no, he reveals himself in the breaking of the bread. And this is really important, too, to mention. Because I think this is part of the answer to the question of why Jesus does not want Mary Magdalene to hold on to him. Don't touch me, literally, stop touching me, it says in the Greek text, because I have not yet ascended to my Father, to my God, and your God. And I think part of it is because if he had stayed on earth in his resurrected body, that would have been super, super distracting from his Eucharistic body. And this is exactly why in the Road to Emmaus account in Luke, he disappears from their sight as soon as he breaks the bread, as soon as he celebrates the Eucharist for these disciples. Whew, it's kind of it's the Mass laid out. It's the liturgy of the word. He's breaking open the scriptures to them on the road to Emmaus. Old Testament scriptures saying how they're really about the Christ, ultimately. He's the subject of all scripture. And then after the quote-unquote liturgy of the word, it's the liturgy of the Eucharist. He breaks bread for them, and whew, it's the Eucharist. And then his resurrected body is gone. And so that we can focus on his Eucharistic presence. I think that's really important. So important. And so this is, I think, part of the reason why Jesus says, don't hang on to me here, because you've got to focus on a couple of different things. Number one is my Eucharistic presence. But number two, you've got to focus on other people at this point. Don't be selfish, if you will. Now, how could she be being selfish? I mean, she's happy to see Jesus alive. But she goes, go and tell the others that I am alive. And this is what she has to do. This is exactly what you and I have to do as well. We have to give away our faith in order to keep it. We have to share our faith with others as much as possible. And this is how we keep that Easter flame going. It's very much like the Easter Vigil. And yesterday on the program, you heard my interview with Jordan Peterson and his wife Tammy when she entered the Catholic Church at the Easter Vigil this year. And if you watch the video on the Relevant Radio website, you'll see scenes of the flame spreading from the Easter Paschal candle to all of the little tapers, the little candles that people hold in the pews, as the church is in complete darkness, but it's lit up with the fire of the resurrected Christ. And we've got to spread that. Just like you pass that flame to the person next to you, we've got to do that as well, one-on-one, sometimes in a group setting for sure. But we've got to share. And we've got to tell people that God calls them by name. And this is, by the way, how Mary recognized Jesus in this passage. She thinks it's the gardener, and she thinks the grave has been robbed. And that was a big problem in the first century world. Caesar had promulgated a whole bunch of penalties for people who robbed graves because it just happened all the time. And she thinks that's what's happened here. And not only has the grave been robbed, but the whole body is gone. But it's Jesus, of course, and she recognizes it's him when he calls her by her name, Mary. And very much this, again, harkens back to something John said earlier in his gospel when he described Jesus as the good shepherd who knows his sheep by name. They know my voice. They know the voice of the good shepherd, and they won't follow another. He knows us intimately, and we've got to get to know him as well. And we've got to help other people to get to know him as well and figure out and understand that he knows their name too. So this is too good. She can't keep it to herself. She's got to go and tell everyone about Jesus. And this is what we've got to do as well. And remember how I said that Jesus is the new Adam, the new man, the God-man. Well, here's another Newman. And I'm talking about not Seinfeld, but Cardinal John Henry Newman, Saint John Henry Newman. And this is one of the most convicting passages I have ever read. And it's from the pen of Blessed John Henry, St. John Henry Cardinal Newman. And when he was beatified, I remember Pope Benedict beatified him when he was in the UK. And it was just an incredible triumph for the Catholics of Britain. And Cardinal Newman has been a hero of mine ever since I discovered him around the time of my reversion back to the Catholic faith in the year 2004. And I was a cradle Catholic. I'd fallen away from my faith when I was in high school, university age, became an agnostic, had all kinds of questions, didn't have great formation in the faith. And my daughter, Michaela, who's 8 years old, was asking me all questions about this last night. What's an agnostic? Well, it's somebody who isn't quite sure what's out there. I never stopped believing in God, but I wasn't sure who had the right God or who God was. And of course, I had to relearn all these things. But eventually, I became, through Protestant campus missionaries, I came back to my faith in Christ, got the apologetics I was missing about Jesus, but I eventually became a Protestant pastor. And during that time, I was very, very happy doing what I was doing. I wasn't looking for this. And when I was on Drew Mariani's show yesterday, just talking about my journey, he asked me about it. And I said, I was so happy when I was a Protestant minister. I loved what I was doing. I wasn't looking for anything else. And I was kind of convinced against my will of the truth of Catholicism. And at first I thought it would be possible for me to sort of stay where I was and try to educate Protestants about Catholic beliefs through preaching and teaching. I didn't think it was necessary for me to actually return to the Catholic Church in body. Well, that was until I met Cardinal Newman, that is. And he made me realize that it wasn't enough to recognize or even promote to others the veracity of the Catholic faith. I actually had to be in corporate union with the church Jesus founded if I hope to attain salvation. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. So once I discovered that the Catholic Church was the church Jesus established, was the true church, I had to enter it. At Lumen Gentium chapter 14 puts it this way. This is one of the Vatican II documents. Whoever therefore, knowing that the Catholic Church was made necessary by Christ, would refuse to enter the church or to remain in the church could not be saved. Wow. And I remember I even before I came into the church, I went to a conference at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, and I remember Patrick Madrid. First time I ever heard Patrick give a talk, he was speaking at the Defending the Faith conference. And I was just very curious. I was checking out Catholic stuff, went there, heard him give this talk, and I remember him talking about this. And it was very convicting to me. It was the first time I'd ever heard about Lumen Gentium chapter 14. And I've told Patrick about this. Hey, he had a, gave me a huge kick in the pants to get back into the Catholic Church. So this is the dangerous thing about truth. Once we recognize what the truth is, we're obliged to act on it. We're obliged to conform our lives to it. And that's something that St. John Henry Newman knew full well. And here's another providential thing that happened. How I got to know about Newman, during my years as a Protestant minister, I was at a conference, another conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I went to a very famous bookstore. It's called the Erdmann's Discount Theological Bookstore. Maybe you've been there. And yeah, Protestant stuff, but it's really, really good theological material. And books are on super discount. Everybody likes to go there. And it was there, of all places, I found a couple of Catholic books about Cardinal Newman. And one of them was written by a Catholic priest who's since passed away, Father Stanley Jackie, very influential, incredible scientist priest. Anyways, this book that he wrote about Newman was called Newman's Challenge. And it's a short little book, but man, I bought this book and it was so convicting. And it was really the final straw, I guess, that broke the camel's back, really pushed me over the edge to go back into the Catholic Church. I read about Newman's conversion to Catholicism, and he was the most famous Protestant in the world. In the world. His conversion made front page news across Europe. It would have been like Billy Graham in his heyday becoming a Catholic. I mean, probably the most famous Protestant in the world. And so he wrote letters. Newman wrote all these letters on the eve of his reception into the Catholic Church. And the most famous Anglican in the world at the time, and that was Newman, he wrote all these personal letters to a lot of his friends, family members, talking about his fellow Anglican clergymen, writing about all his reasons for entering the Church of Rome. And a lot of people, they just couldn't believe he was doing this. And in one of those letters, here's a quote from him. This is why he couldn't keep silent about what he had discovered about Catholicism. Here's the quote. And this is from Father Stanley Jackie's book, kind of going over all these letters. Newman revealed the innermost recesses of his powerful mind by repeating what he was, that he was about to be received into the one true fold. That's the one true sheepfold. Again, this comes from John's gospel. This idea that there's one flock, one shepherd. And the one true fold, the one true sheepfold was a phrase he used again and again and again. So a letter that he wrote on October the 9th, 1845, he assured his sister that, and this is quoting Newman himself, quote, "If I thought that any other body than that which I recognize to be Catholic were to be recognized by the Savior of the world, I would not have left that body." And 5 days later, he wrote again to his sister that it would have been a betrayal of truth. And he wrote that in capital letters, truth. If he had kept from others his most considered conviction that the Church of Rome was the Catholic Church. Newman told his sister that he could not live with a conscience guilty of something called dissimulation, the guilt that he had deprived others of the truth, with a capital T. Here's another quote from Newman. "What a doom would have been mine if I had kept the truth a secret in my bosom, and when I knew which the one church was and which was not part of the one church, I had suffered friends and strangers to die in an ignorance from which I might have relieved them," end of quote. Newman knew which was the pain to be dreaded more, the temporal pain he would feel because he had to pain others. Like, they're not going to understand what I'm doing. They're going to get angry. They're going to get upset with me. They might even never speak to me again. The temporal pain he would feel because he had to pain other people, or the eternal pain that he would eventually suffer if he chose not to pain them and not to inspire others to convert as he did. Whew. Those are powerful words. And that's all in the book. And if you can find this book, you got to grab it. It's called Newman's Challenge by Father Stanley Jackie, J-A-K-I. I don't know if it's still in print, but this one is published by Erdmans. And this really just affected me a lot. Like all these letters he wrote to his colleagues on the eve of his conversion. The Church of Rome, the Catholic Church, is the church Jesus founded. It's the one true church, the one true fold. And what a doom would be mine if I didn't tell people about this, if I'd suffered friends and strangers to die in an ignorance from which I could have relieved them. You know, how's God going to deal with me if I don't tell people about this, essentially? And so this is exactly what Jesus is saying to Mary Magdalene here. You got to tell others that I'm alive. And we have to tell people not only that Jesus is alive, but that the church is his mystical body on earth. In a sense, it's kind of you can look at it as an extension of the incarnation through you and I, Christ. We are his hands and feet now on planet Earth as we spread this message across the world. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show. 888, you can call in, 888-914-9149. Be right back.
You keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149 is the number to call to talk to me for free. We were talking about Mary Magdalene before the break. Let's go to another Mary, Mary Lou, in Redlands, California, in SoCal. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hi, Cale. It's me, Mary Lou. The body knows. We talked a few weeks ago.
Thank you for calling back.
I want to give you a chance because I talk too much. So I kind of want to like pace this so I could have cohesive thoughts because I'm so excited to be on the race young with you. And like you, by the way, thank you for that interview with Tammy Peterson. It was absolutely beautiful. They're both my favorites. Anyway, I love that you mentioned Mary Magdalene and that she was the apostle to the apostles. And, you know, I'm an ex-secular feminist. And when I became a Catholic at the age of 30, I let all of that go. And Our Lady handed me back my femininity. And then it was other women like Sister Teresa Benedict of the Cross, the Carmelite feminist, kind of feminist a little bit. Strong lady. And then you talked about the apostle to the apostles, that feminine authority in the church, and not authority trying to take over or be like the secular feminist, but to be in our wisdom as women, like we do have a voice. And just thank you so much for mentioning that and giving us kind of, not that I need credit, because I don't really need credit, but as a woman, we often do kind of tell you guys, hey, because we have a different perspective and the masculine has a different perspective. So sometimes it's hard for us to trust. Men don't trust. Well, it came from a woman, you know, it's ever since Eve. But, you know, Mary redeemed that. Our Lady redeemed that. And then it was interesting how you did the parallel in the garden. I'd never heard anybody do the parallel from Magdalene in the garden to Genesis. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, just this whole idea that the tomb was in a garden, She thinks he's the gardener. Well, who was the original gardener? It was Adam, right? And so Jesus is that second Adam. He succeeds in every way that Adam failed. Adam let the snake in the garden. He let the serpent into the garden and didn't. He wasn't doing his job. He was asleep at the switch. Serpent intimidates his wife, and then she winds up sinning, and he goes along with it. And so the new Eve, Mary, the new Adam, Jesus, they kind of collaborate in reversing the curse, if you will. And I do think, yeah, you mentioned Edith Stein, and it was great that my daughter Michaela was listening to the Edith Stein episodes of The Merry Beggars, just really enjoying it. And I thought they did an amazing job, by the way, so kudos to Peter Atkinson and the crew. I thought, how are they going to pull this off? They actually talked about phenomenology at a level that a kid could understand. That was a major achievement, believe me. And Edith Stein was a brilliant philosopher. And John Paul II talked about her a lot in talking about the feminine genius. And even in my conversation with Jordan Peterson and Tammy, and some stuff that didn't make it into the interview just because we had some time constraints, but we had some bonus material that I hope to share with you down the road. We talked a lot about the feminine genius and how Mary really represents true femininity in a world where that is skewed in so many different ways because of misconceptions of what true feminism is, what it means to be a woman, there's just so much that could be said there. That's a whole show unto itself. But Mary, happy Easter to you. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate you. God bless you.
Thank you. Happy Easter.
And happy Easter to you. Call back soon. Mary Lou in Redlands, California. All right, let's go to Doug. We're going to stick in the Golden State. We're going to go to Glendale, California. Hi, Doug.
Yes, hi. My question is that why do you think that Jesus was not recognized at first following the resurrection, and yet later with the encounter with Thomas, of course, he was clear that it was Jesus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good question. Like, this is part of the, like I talked about, and I'm not 100% sure exactly why it is that the disciples on the road to Emmaus didn't recognize Jesus at first. I don't know. Maybe he was wearing a hoodie pulled up over his head. Who knows? But we do know this, that when Jesus appears to the 11 really now, of course, and then Thomas is there. He wasn't there the first time. This is also in John's gospel. He invites Thomas to check out the wounds. And we're not told whether he actually does touch the side of Christ where he was speared. I would have done it. Probably you would have done it as well. I'm totally going to do that if I'm Thomas. And I think this is the thing. The wounds are Jesus's ID. And there is something different about the resurrected state of Jesus. It is him. There's continuity, there's discontinuity. They know it's the same Jesus that was crucified. He's still sporting the wounds. He didn't have to keep those wounds, I don't think, just like he doesn't have to eat anything either. And in Luke's gospel, it's reported that he eats really the filet fish. You know, do you have anything here to eat? Well, I got some bread, some fish. All right, slap it together and eat it. Why is he doing that? He's showing them that he's not a spirit. He's not a ghost. He has a physical, corporeal body. He can make food disappear. Ghosts can't do that. So he's showing the reality. And again, the wounds are his ID. This is how it's unmistakably him. The same Christ that was crucified publicly for all to see has now risen from the dead. And it's interesting. I don't have the actual details at the tip of my fingers here, but I have heard of some false apparitions that have appeared to people and certain saints. And one in particular, and I can't remember who it was, where allegedly it was Jesus appearing. I don't know whether it was Padre Pio. The saint said, yeah, show me the wounds. If it's really Jesus, if it's really you, show me the wounds. And that's when the apparition revealed itself to be the devil. Get out of here. Be gone, Satan. Because it's obviously illegitimate. He doesn't have those wounds. So I don't know. Like part of it's mysterious and part of it I can't answer, but maybe he just didn't show the wounds at those other times, Doug, but he certainly did in the case of Thomas. Does that help a little bit?
Perhaps his wounds in his hands or wrists were not noticed at first.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah, that's possible. Was he dressed in anything is a good question. There's some writers who comment on the book of Genesis, and I mentioned this when we went through the book of Genesis on the Faith Explained show, that they postulate that the first human beings were kind of robed in garments of light, if you will. in their state pre-fall, which is kind of interesting to think about. So maybe, I don't know. And certainly the transfiguration of Jesus too, right? Which is kind of a sneak preview of his glorified state. His clothes become so white that there's, as Mark says, there was no launderer in the world who could get him that white. Forget about your Tide Pods. It's not going to work. This is supernatural detergent, if you will. So, yeah, I mean, who knows? These are great questions that are somewhat left unanswered for us. But, hey, Doug, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate you, and call back anytime.
Well, thank you very much.
You got it. God bless you. Happy Easter. All right. Let's go to Joe in Lombard, Illinois, in Chicagoland. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you? You know, just a thought on why they say perhaps Mary Magdalene didn't recognize Jesus. It may not be any more mysterious than she just had absolutely no expectation of finding him there at that moment in time. And, you know, who might be there early in the morning? Well, perhaps the gardener. I think we've all had the experience of going into a room thinking, my eyeglasses probably are not here, but I'll just take a quick look anyway. And then you look elsewhere and all around, and you end up in the same room again. There they are, you know, because it's all expectations. So I don't know that we have to go to the mystical every time. Sometimes it's just us.
Yeah, it's so true. I agree with you 100%. She had no expectation necessarily that he would be alive. She came to anoint the body, and there was a period of mourning that would take place in these tombs. And I've seen several examples of these in the Holy Land, these first century tombs. There was kind of an area where you could get in. You just needed somebody to roll the stone away, which is a difficult task. You get in there, and then there's a place where for you to stand and pray. And then the body is put in a niche. It's called a coke. Kokim is the plural term. There are all these niches for people's bodies to be put in, and then the flesh decomposes. You come back in a year, collect the bones, put it in a bone box, an ossuary, and then they're put sort of in a niche, a permanent place of rest. And that's exactly what Mary was going there to do, to anoint and to pray. And she got the surprise of her life, that Jesus was alive. Absolutely. Thank you, Joe. God bless you, and happy Easter to you. Let's go now to Paul in Wisconsin, central Wisconsin. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just happened to stumble across your program here. I was flipping through the radio. And, I had a question maybe you can shed some light on. I don't want to come across as being down on the Catholic Church or anything, but I was brought into the faith with Roman Catholic Church and went through, got all the, what do you call it?
Sacraments. And
Yes, all the sacraments, and got married, went to Catholic Church, Catholic school. I never had really a connection to Jesus at all. And I went to a Christian church. I'm originally from the Chicago area. And I couldn't make my regular mass. So I went to the Catholic or the Christian church. And I found it so welcoming. And so I went back to my Bible study with my Catholic buddies. And I told them I was interested in his church. And they turned on me like you wouldn't believe it. I was going to a cult and all this other stuff. And I'm like, don't we worship the same Jesus and same God? Why do you have to be this way? So I don't know. That's my question, I guess. Maybe you have an answer for me.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, you're talking to a guy in me who I also, you know, left the Catholic Church and spent about 10 years in the world of evangelicals and independent churches, independent Protestant Christian churches, and found my way back home into the Catholic Church. And I certainly learned a lot during my time in the evangelical world, and there are a lot of things that evangelicals do that are super appealing. One of the things that you mentioned, certainly the hospitality factor, that they were very welcoming to you and invited you to Bible study, and maybe you never saw anything like that in the Catholic Church. And these are things that we should be kind of paying attention to and maybe trying to learn from a little bit. But ultimately, it's not about what we like better. And I remember, like, even in my Protestant days, like, there were people who would leave our congregation and go to another one down the road. And why did you do that? Well, I like the pastor better at the other. I like the preaching better. I like the homily. Or they got a great program for my children. Love the music. I mean, there are all these different reasons, but they all boil down to the same one, which is I like this better. So really the question we should be asking is, what does God like? What worship does God like and want and command? And that happens to be the Mass. That is the Mass. That's why Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. I'm instituting the Eucharist here at the Last Supper, and you guys have to perpetuate this. You guys have to offer this holy sacrifice in the Mass. And that's what happened in the early church. And so we kind of have to adopt ourselves to what God wants. The Catholic Church was founded by Jesus Christ, and he wants all Christians. He wants all of your Protestant friends to be part of it as well. He founded it for them, for you, for me, for everybody. And, you know, all these groups, it's a long story if you look through the history, how they came to be. But eventually, you go back to the fact that all of Christianity was really united in one church, the Catholic Church. And then the Orthodox churches of the East split off. And then eventually the Protestant movement started in the 16th century. And all of these modern-day evangelical Protestant churches can sort of trace their origins back to that. And they all have things that really ultimately belong to the one Catholic Church. They have pieces of the truth, but they don't have the whole picture. They've got the Bible, yeah. And yes, we do worship the same God, but they don't have other things that they're missing. They don't have the sacraments. They don't have the Eucharist. They don't have confession. So there's so many things that Jesus wants them to have and experience, so many gifts that he's given to the church that he wants them to have and they don't have. But they're doing amazing things with what they do have, and it's kind of putting us to shame, especially with Scripture and how they spread the word. But I don't know if that helps at all, Paul. It's a big topic to raise. But
no, I know, but I guess will you go by the Bible? That's your guide, that's your go-to is God's word, right? Just as I do. And I read the Bible several times through, and I've never saw anything about you have to go to an intermediary to talk to God. And that's what my problem was with the Catholic Church for many years. Like, why do I need to talk to this man to talk to my creator? I guess that's my thing. So I'm sorry. I don't mean to be negative or anything, but thanks for taking my call, though.
Yeah, no problem. But what do you, just to clarify, Paul, what you mean by this, but what do you mean by an intermediary? You have to talk to an intermediary to get to God. Are you talking about the saints? Are you talking about?
Yeah, the priests. Yeah, and all the saints that they worship, you know, Mary, you know, we're supposed to worship God and Jesus, not
right.
Mary, you know, Mother of
well,
God
we don't,
or Mary Magdalene. Or,
yeah, well, first of all, we don't worship Mary. If anybody does worship Mary, they're committing the sin of idolatry. Worshiping a creature instead of the creator. She's a great creature, the greatest, greater than all the angels. In fact, only God is greater than her, but we don't worship her. We only worship God. We only worship God. In terms of the priest, now you can, of course, talk directly to God. Of course, anyone can. But when it comes to certain things, like Jesus sort of set it up this way. Like if you read the Bible, if you read John chapter 20, this is where the sacrament of confession is set up. After the resurrection, Jesus breathes on them and says, receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, they are forgiven. If you retain anyone's sins, they're not forgiven. And how would they know that unless the people told them their sins? And so this is confession right there in the Scriptures. And so, and this is a gift. Again, it's a way for Jesus to get directly to us through this. You can't get any closer to Jesus than receiving him in the Eucharist, for example, his body, blood, soul, and divinity. If it's really Jesus, you can't get any closer to God without dying. So talk about direct contact with Jesus. There it is right there. So, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe take a fresh look, Paul. I mean, this is one thing we do a lot, especially on our sister program, The Faith Explained. We go through Scripture a lot, and we understand that the Bible was a Catholic book. It was written by Catholics, put together by the Catholic Church long before any Protestant denomination ever came to be. So I'm not trying to be arrogant in saying this, but it's a Catholic book, so it's not in contradiction to the Catholic faith. I know it's
well,
a new perspective, maybe, to think about.
We conversation in person, I guess, so.
Well, I tell you, call in again and stay on the journey. I'm so glad that you did, Paul. We have a lot of people who are not Catholics who call in, and I'm so thankful for that, and I'm glad you did call into Relevant Radio today as you're driving across central Wisconsin somewhere, I'd imagine.
Listen. Yeah. Thank you for taking my call, and God bless you guys, and keep up the faith.
Well, you too, Paul. God bless you. I hope to hear from you again, be praying for you, and God bless you and enjoy the rest of this Easter octave. All right, we got to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show, but we'll be right back. 888-914-9149.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the program. 888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're going to get right back to your phone calls in just a second, but I did want to mention, I don't know how many of you guys watched the game last night between, I was going to say between Caitlin Clark and LSU, but it's really, of course, the University of Iowa Hawkeyes women's basketball team against LSU. It was a rematch of last year's NCAA championship game on the women's side, which was quite the affair. There was a lot of bad blood, a lot of trash talking between those two teams, between Caitlin Clark and her counterpart on LSU, Angel Reese, also a great player. Well, Iowa got their revenge last night to get back into the Final Four. They defeated LSU. Caitlin Clark dropped 41 points. I would say she's probably maybe the most recognizable athlete in sports right now. I defy anybody to name, if you're just sort of a casual sports fan, can you name anybody on, say, the UConn men's basketball team who are the defending champs on the men's side? I don't know if you could name more than two or three players for sure, if anybody, but everybody kind of knows Caitlin Clark right now. And here's a little clip from last night's game with the call from ESPN's Ryan Rucco. Check it out.
Clark connects. Clark backdoor. Martin, easy two. Clark, you bet. Could you have possibly asked for a better start if you're Iowa? In a rematch with LSU, Clark evades. That will do it. This time, it's Iowa. The Hawkeyes are headed back to the Final Four.
Unbelievable. And we had a bit of a glitch in the system. I don't know if people heard what I said, Jim, at the beginning. Oh, they did. Okay, great. Fantastic. So I won't repeat myself then, but I do want to tell you this. I think the numbers are probably out now, but I did hear from a source that apparently the overnight Nielsen ratings for this game on ESPN last night between LSU and Iowa, rematch of last year's women's championship game, apparently it was approaching, if not more than 10 million overnight views. That's unbelievable for a women's NCAA championship game. It would have been unheard of just a few years ago. Well, I think the Final Four is probably going to get even more boffo ratings because I was playing UConn. The famous UConn Huskies women's team. Yep, they're in the men's side too, defending champs, but it's going to be UConn against Iowa in one semifinal, and then South Carolina against NC State in the second on Friday night. But there's an interesting piece, by the way, up on ESPN by Wright Thompson. It's a long-form written piece, and it's really long. It's really long about Caitlin Clark, but it's really, really well done. And she does come, of course, from a Catholic family. She went to Catholic school from kindergarten all the way through high school grad. She comes from her mom, Anne, comes from a very big, loud, fun Italian family, according to Wright Thompson. And he says, if you look in Caitlin's fridge at the apartment that she now lives in with one of her teammates, you'll find some frozen red sauce meals made by her mom or by her grandma. Her brother, Blake, is always texting her, reminding her, hey, Caitlin, don't forget to pray your rosary. And don't forget to go to Mass on Sunday. There's actually a church near campus. It's right across the street, apparently from a great dive bar called George's, which is where a lot of fans and even coaches, including their head coach, Bluter, and her staff go to celebrate big wins. And apparently, according to Wright Thompson, he's got a friend who actually is a parishioner at that church, and he checked with her, and Caitlin Clark is there on the regular. So she does apparently fulfill her Sunday obligation. Her brother Blake wore his St. Benedict bracelet to the Final Four last year. And when he was with Wright Thompson, he prayed four decades of the rosary at the hotel, and he did get in that fifth decade right before tip-off for the championship game. So they're pretty serious about their faith. And that's why it was a big kind of disappointment to Caitlin Clark's parents that she did not choose the University of Notre Dame. They wanted her to go there, and that was really her first move to sort of get a bit of independence and make her own decisions. She actually had committed to Notre Dame and Coach Muffet McGraw, but had to call her back a few days later. She never did sort of sign the letter of intent, and she had to break it to her folks. She was sweating buckets, and she said, I'm going to actually stay in Iowa. And it was the right choice for her, absolutely, and she's become just a superstar. I mean, approaching Gretzky, Jordan-like notoriety, unbelievable. So congratulations to Caitlin Clark in Iowa for making it to another Final Four. Let's go. Oh, one more thing, too. I gotta give a shout-out here before we go back to the phones. Shout-out to Emily Sturgeon in our men's pool here at Relevant Radio. Emily from our marketing department. I couldn't believe this. She actually had all four Final Four teams on the men's side. UConn, Alabama, Purdue, and, of course, NC State. NC State and Alabama were kind of the shockers, I guess. But Emily did graduate from Alabama, so, of course, she's going to put that in. But NC State, wow, what a call. Unbelievable. So I still have Purdue winning over UConn. I still got my championship game, but I only had two of the Final Four teams. So, hey, I'm not a prophet after all. Let's go to the phones. Gretchen is in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, Mr. Clark. How are you?
I'm doing great. Happy Easter to you.
Well, I was just walking the beach and listening to your show and listening to the conversations that you were having in regards to Mary not recognizing Jesus when she was at the tomb. And I was having a thought that perhaps it's because the last time that she had seen him, he was just a bloody mess. His face was disfigured, his back was scourged, and he was just an absolute mess. And there she finds him, and he's risen and beautiful and glorious. And maybe she was just so amazed that it was really him. Mm-hmm. He looked so different from the way that she had just seen him.
That's probably part of it. By the way, Gretchen, I have to tell you, this idea of walking on the beach and listening to the show sounds pretty good to me. I've always felt strangely called to a beach ministry. I can't figure out why. But anyways, thanks for calling in. And yeah, this is part of the continuity and discontinuity of Jesus and his resurrected body. There's a bit of a mysteriousness about it. Sometimes people are kept from recognizing him. But again, this is one of the reasons why he still sports the wounds, I think. That's his ID. Let's go now thanks, Gretchen. Let's go to Cheryl in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there. I was also calling about, I kind of caught it a little bit later. I'm on listening on the app and heard the discussion about the disciples on the road to Emmaus not recognizing Jesus. And I had just recently read Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist. I don't know if you ever...
Great book. By Dr. Brant Petre.
Yeah, it's so good. It's like reading a mystery almost, because there's just so much information packed into it. You want to keep reading. But towards the end, there's a chapter on the road to Emmaus. And what it points out is that people read it and they see it as they didn't recognize him. But it doesn't say that. It says that their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And it wasn't until after they broke the bread with him, and basically he did the same thing as the Last Supper. He repeated the Last Supper where he instituted the Eucharist, that then they knew him. And so the book was kind of saying that this was his way of showing them that this was how they would see him, and that he's not bound by space and time. And so I just thought that was kind of a really cool bit of
it
information.
Is. Oh, absolutely. And thanks for mentioning that book. That's a great book for people to go out and order from Dr. Brant Petre, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist. Amazing. And he has actually a longer version of that book. It's more like a scholarly book. It's hundreds of pages long. But I think he's one of the best young Catholic scholars in the world, maybe the best. And he teaches at the Augustine Institute. All of his stuff is just amazing. So highly recommended for sure. Absolutely. And this is part of the truth that Jesus, of course, he comes to us in his physical body at the incarnation, which was, of course, resurrected from the dead. That's what we're celebrating this week. He also comes to us in his Eucharistic body and also in his mystical body, the church. And so we really need all three ways that Christ, all three bodies, I guess you could say, that Christ wants to touch our lives. And we've got to be a part of it. And this is just the great, great celebration of Easter that we are in all week long. It's an 8-day festival, and of course, it concludes with the Sunday of Divine Mercy, which is happening this coming Sunday. Unbelievable. And we have, unfortunately, it happens to us all the time, we have run out of time. We've only got about a minute or so left, right, Jim? About 1 minute, yeah. Alan and Mesa, I want to take your call. I want you to call back tomorrow, okay? Because it's a great call, and we don't have time for it. But I wish I had a longer show, but we're up against the clock. Ellen, Jose, Mary, Julie, Claire, I want you to call back tomorrow because very, very important stuff, important questions. But I'm always tempted to take another call, but my wife always says, Cale, don't do it, man. I know you want to squeeze it in, but so I'm going to listen to my better angels here and say that is it. And there's the music. But you can check out the podcast if you missed anything. And also check out the interview that I had with Jordan and Tammy Peterson. If you haven't got a chance to share this on social media with your friends, even Jordan Peterson shared it. We want you to do the same as well. Jim Schaefer produced, and Patrick Kalock took your phone calls today. Timmy's up next. Happy Easter, everyone. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.